This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello and welcome to the second hour of the USA Today. This is Doug Jenkins, and during this hour I'll be bringing columns from the opinion section and articles from the money section of the USA Today, and the columns and articles will be from the February 8th, 2024 edition of the USA Today. Leading us off is this column from opinion contributor William DeMasio. It's entitled, "Can Trump Be Disqualified in Every State? Chaos May Follow Supreme Court Ballot Ruling." The Supreme Court will hear oral arguments Thursday about its latest dilemma. Should former President Donald Trump be forever disqualified from the presidency, or can it find a way to sidestep the Constitution? Section 3 of the 14th Amendment says anyone who has taken the oath of office to defend the Constitution and then engages in insurrection may never hold the high office again. Highly respected legal scholars contend Trump is disqualified because of his participation in the assault on the Capitol on January 6, 2021. Yet Trump is already running for the 2024 GOP nomination and has won primary events in both Iowa and New Hampshire. And the former president has intimated that bedlam might ensue if he is kept off the ballot. The case now before the Supreme Court stems from Trump's appeal to a 5-4 decision by the Colorado Supreme Court to disqualify him because of Section 3. Will Supreme Court choose the Constitution or Donald Trump? Given the oath the justices take to defend the Constitution, as well as the deference the High Court typically accords to state courts on most election matters, it seems like a slam dunk that the ruling will favor Colorado's decision. But that is not entirely clear, and there is also the issue of where it would leave the other states. Here are the words of Section 3. No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress, or elector of president and vice president, or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress, or as an officer of the United States, or as a member of any state legislature, or as an executive or judicial officer of any state, to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. Unless the court declares its eventual decision to be applicable nationwide, another form of chaos could prevail, with each state making its own ruling on ballot access. Frequently cited on this issue is The Sweep and Force of Section 3, a thoughtful article by law professors William Bowd and Michael Stokes Paulson, members of the Conservative Federalist Society. The Constitution is not optional, and Section 3 is not an optional part of the Constitution, they write. Importantly, it is also wrong to shrink from applying Section 3 on grounds of democracy, whether on the premise that Section 3 should be ignored or narrowly construed because it limits who voters may choose, or on the premise that only the voters should enforce Section 3. Bowd and Paulson parenthetically note the irony of those invoking democracy as a defense for their actions in attempting to overthrow constitutional order at the Capitol. The lawyers contend that many officials participated in the insurrection and should be held accountable. Donald Trump is at the top of the list of Section 3 disqualifications, but the list does not end with him, they conclude. Will Trump be disqualified from running in every state? Capital University constitutional law professor Mark Brown said the court will most likely find a way to avoid an outright nationwide ban against Trump. My gut tells me they will not disqualify Trump, even though I think they should, he said in an interview. They could say Section 3 does not apply to the president. They could also say some kind of formal fact-finding is needed to determine if an insurrection occurred. Or they could leave it to the other states to decide for themselves who will be on their ballots. Additionally, he added, there is a question of ballot access versus holding office. We've never seen this before, so it's going to be interesting. Section 3 of the amendment was adopted after the Civil War and aimed at preventing rebellious Confederates from seeking seats in Congress and other high offices after the war ended. It's important to consider that this prohibition is not a statute passed by a hyper-partisan Congress. The very wording of the amendment must have been approved by a two-thirds vote of both chambers and then ratified by three-fourths of the states. It is fundamental to the rule of law. In the August Atlantic edition, Harvard Law professor Lawrence Tribe and retired federal judge J. Michael Luttig wrote, "Section 3's disqualification clause has by no means outlived its contemplated necessity, nor will it ever, as the post-Civil War framers presciently foresaw. To the contrary, this provision of our Constitution continues to protect the Republic from those bent on its dissolution." Public perceptions of the Supreme Court vary, often because of seemingly political decisions such as Bush v. Gore settling the presidential election of 2000, or controversial rulings such as the Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization decision overturning the Roe v. Wade ruling on abortion. Pew Research Center findings indicate favorable ratings of the nation's highest court have declined 26 percentage points since 2020, and Pew's most recent survey shows for the first time in its polling since 1987 that the public views the high court significantly more negative than positive. The Supreme Court is the third equal leg of American governance. By virtue of the lifetime tenure of its justices, it is the only branch shielded from partisanship or public pressure. The decision in this dispute ought to be about defending the rule of law as it is written and without fear or favor or legalistic hair-splitting. Bowden Paulson concluded that those who possess the power and duty to apply and enforce Section 3 have a constitutional responsibility to do so fairly but vigorously. In other words, the Supreme Court should simply do the right thing and decide this issue for the nation. William Damasio is a retired journalist who lives in Upper Arlington, Ohio, and this column first appeared in the Columbus Dispatch. "Don't believe the narrative that Gen Z will vote Biden. My generation is up for grabs." And that's the title of this next column from the USA Today's Dace Potas. The great irony about being a Gen Z voter is that everybody agrees will likely be the decisive vote in the 2024 presidential election, but both political parties are taking us for granted. Democrats think they have our vote locked up, and Republicans don't even want to speak to the issues my generation is most passionate about. While Generation Z, born between 1997 and 2012, has widely been viewed as a new bedrock for Democrats to rely on in election season, they should not count on Gen Z showing up this election, and Republicans should look at my generation as an opportunity for their political future. Will Gen Z continue to vote Democrat? In a recent Harvard poll of 18 to 29-year-olds, only 49% said they definitely will be voting in 2024, a drop from the contentious 2020 election in which more than 50% of Americans under 30 voted for president. While the poll reaffirms the Democrats' advantage among the youth vote, with 41% of that population saying they'll vote for Joe Biden and only 30% for Donald Trump, the lack of enthusiasm for this election cycle could spell trouble for Democrats. In 2020, young people were invigorated by both the COVID-19 pandemic and the racial tensions following the death of George Floyd. Coupled with the economic decline stemming from pandemic shutdowns, Gen Z voters had little incentive to give Trump another 4 years. Democrats are still in the advantage when it comes to key issues for Gen Z. Abortion, climate change, and gun violence are in the top five for most important issues across my generation, according to Tufts polling. Abortion in particular is a massive issue for Gen Z, and one that they favor Democrats on heavily. 70% of voters under 30 support no restrictions on abortion. Despite Biden's low approval rating, The stance is widely credited with the Democrats' good midterm elections performance, particularly in states with abortion referendums on the ballot. Republicans still don't care about young voters. Despite Democrats' advantage on social issues, Republicans do have some opportunity in front of them, particularly on the number one issue for Gen Z. Almost 40% of the Tufts poll listed inflation and gas prices as their top concern. As much as the pundit class wants to claim the economy is fully recovered, Gen Z doesn't seem to agree. In Bank of America's annual Better Money Habits survey, nearly three-quarters of Gen Z said they've changed spending habits in response to inflation, and just 24% believe that the economy will improve over the next year. In the Harvard poll, Trump holds a 15% point advantage when it comes to Gen Z trust on the economy as a whole, and Republicans ought to press their advantage. With Trump, his personality was always unfavorable among the broad voting populations, but that could be excused by his handling of the economy, which 63% of Americans approved of immediately before COVID-19 struck. However, the GOP has entirely neglected speaking to Gen Z about social issues that Democrats pose a large advantage on, and this is something that needs to change. Even if we cannot compete with the empty promise of $20,000 debt forgiveness, we must confront these social issues in order to provide some alternative to Democrats. The Gen Z vote might be up for grabs if anybody will listen. The GOP will need more to sway young voters and take advantage of an opportunity. Democrats have provided. The economic future of our country is an issue in which Republicans hold an advantage, and they would be wise to press it, but it alone cannot turn the tides as we saw in the 2022 midterms. Young people are less enthusiastic about Biden than they were in 2020, and the economic pain that they have suffered is a big part of that. Large numbers sitting out, or even a decent chunk defecting to the GOP, would be excellent for Republicans' chances of retaking the White House and Senate. If Democrats have any interest in winning 2024, which means appealing to young voters, not pushing them away on such controversies as the Israel-Hamas war. The White House will be decided in part by whether Gen Z thinks voting matters, and both sides would be wise to listen to our voice. Dace Potas is an opinion fellow for USA Today, a graduate from DePaul University with a degree in political science. He's also president of the Lone Conservative, the largest conservative student-run publication in the country. Rex Hupke of the USA Today has this next column from the opinion section. Nevada primary voters show it's time for GOP to take none of these candidates seriously. There's a new dark horse candidate in the GOP presidential race following Tuesday night's shocking primary results in Nevada, and its name is none of these candidates. There was an expectation Nikki Haley would win the night, given that she was the only major candidate on the ballot. But in a twist few saw coming, over 63% of voters chose none of these candidates, the conservative option that, for my money, makes the most sense. Haley's defenders pointed out that she hadn't campaigned in Nevada, but I imagine none of these candidates' defenders would argue, yeah, but you were basically the only name on the ballot, and you still lost to literally nobody. Former president and current criminal defendant Donald Trump was not on the ballot, but will take part in the state's Republican-run caucus Thursday. It will be interesting to see if none of these candidates can ride the momentum from its big primary win and make some noise at a caucus Trump is expected to dominate. Republicans should give none of these candidates a chance. I'm a liberal fellow, but I've been paying attention to none of these candidates throughout the GOP primary race, and I have to say, it's definitely the smartest and most sensible choice. From the jump, none of these candidates has been more appealing than Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and less confused about slavery than Haley, and its lack of state and federal indictments make it a safer choice for conservatives pondering another vote for Trump. It's also an outside-the-box campaign, taking an innovative absence of candidate approach and trying to reach the sane voters who look at the Republican primary field and say, yeah, not so much with whatever that mess is. The surprise Nevada winner, none of these candidates is catching on. From a policy standpoint, none of these candidates effectively mirrors what remaining competitors Haley and Trump stand for, nothing. At the same time, none of these candidates offers a welcoming void into which Republican voters can deposit their fears, concerns, and dreams for the future, all while guaranteeing the party will continue to lead in a rudderless manner, devoid of humanity and wholly resistant to accountability. You can't impeach none of these candidates, can you? Buoyed by its surprise Nevada victory, none of these candidates should see a surge in funding that will carry it through to the remaining state primaries. I, for one, would be more than happy to donate to its not-that-specific super PAC, which I assume is called None of This is Going Anywhere. A Trump debate against none of these candidates would be a must-watch TV. In fact, if campaign officials for none of these candidates are smart, they'll challenge Trump to a televised debate, giving the American people a chance to decide if they prefer the former president's loud babbling or the peaceful calm and silence of absolute nothingness. As someone who believes it's good for the country to have two strong, functioning political parties, I hope GOP voters take a long look at none of these candidates and imagine the good that might come from having no one run for president. It honestly couldn't get any worse for them. And again, that column is from Rex Hupke of the USA Today. Grandpa's strawberry dessert takes a seedy turn in Olympic skaters' doping report. And this is by Christine Brennan of the USA Today. On the second anniversary of the 2022 Olympic team figure skating competition, 730 days after the beginning of one of the most tortured doping sagas in international sports history, the Court of Arbitration for Sport released its very serious 129-page decision on the Kamila Valieva case. In a nutshell, here's what we learned. Valieva claimed the banned substance that was in her body got there because she ate her grandfather's strawberry dessert. CAS didn't fall for it. Little more than a week ago, a three-member CAS panel threw the book at Valieva, suspending her for 4 years and disqualifying her Olympic results. But in a preposterous twist that seems entirely appropriate for this ridiculous story, the arduous journey into the depths of Russian cheating and the abject failures of international sports officials has now landed in the Valieva family kitchen, more precisely, in Grandpa's strawberry dessert. In the report, which CAS made public Wednesday, Valieva said the prohibited substance, the banned heart medication tremtazidine, entered her body because she ate a strawberry dessert her grandfather made on a chopping block, the same chopping block that he also used to crush his medicine, according to Valieva, who was 15 at the time. What did CAS have to say about this? The CAS panel determined that this explanation was not corroborated by any concrete evidence and that the athlete was not able to establish that she had not committed the anti-doping rule violation intentionally. In other words, nice try, see you in 4 years. In the CAS decision, the word doping is mentioned 217 times. The name Valieva appears 105 times. Then the story takes an unexpected turn from Lance Armstrong to Julia Child. The word dessert is in the report 75 times, and strawberry, a whopping 43 times. Alas, nary a mention of tart or shortcake. As a comparison, the word Olympics appears only 14 times. Valieva's strawberry dessert excuse is actually just one of three she tried out, according to the CAS report. In a July 2022 interview with the Russian anti-doping agency, which itself was suspended from 2015 to 2018 for helping Russian athletes cheat, she first went with what we'll call the "Grandpa tainted the dessert" defense. Said Valieva, "Yes, we had lunch. Grandfather also often gave me something like apple puree or a berry sweet made from berries, condensed milk, bananas, or some juice, and maybe... He also takes pills for following the doctor's recommendations, and probably this pill got into a dessert, which he usually gives to me. Or I saw a few times accidentally that he crushed the pills with a knife and dissolves them in a glass and took them. So I might have drunk from the same glass or there at home. I might have eaten something from the same chopping board and so on. The added benefit of this line of defense is that it's at least two excuses in one. The second version is so simple and general that it basically works for any doping violation. The contamination of some medications, as this happened before, those situations arose, and that is why that could not be excluded. And the third version? It calls out security at the 2021 Russian National Figure Skating Championships, where Valieva tested positive, suggesting who knows who could have done who knows what. Quote, in St. Petersburg, in comparison with organization of other events with Sochi or Olympic Games, the narrative during the Russian championship in St. Petersburg was not really good, as the premises where the athletes were coming in, warming up, eating, and generally getting ready before start were full of strangers who definitely should not be there. So there were a lot of relatives of the athletes who were freely moving around, had free access to the dressing room as well as to the area where athletes were eating. Mother's friend also got an accreditation. However, I cannot say she is somehow relevant to sport, but she still got the accreditation with high level of access so she could get to the areas. The quick takeaway from this excuse? While Russian figure skating security clearly needs to up its game, mother's friend definitely knows how to work the Russian skating credentialing system. All of this sounds less like the legal machinations of a youngster like Valieva and more like the stunningly awful advice of her Russian lawyers. Over the years, international athletes have offered dozens of nonsensical excuses for doping violations, from cocaine-laced anesthesia to kissing the wrong person to a tainted burrito. Grandpa's strawberry dessert fits right in. The very serious result of all this ridiculousness is that Valieva has been banned from December 2021 until December 2025, and her stellar performance in the team competition, which led Russia to the 2022 Olympic gold medal, has been erased. Last week, the International Skating Union, the worldwide governing body for figure skating, reordered the Beijing Olympic results, putting the United States into first place, Japan into second, and dropping Russia to third, although it appears the ISU failed to follow its own rules and basic math and should have put Canada into third place. But that's another controversy for another day, month, or year. Right now, we just want to know what Grandpa is fixing tonight for dessert. And again, that one is from Christine Brennan of the USA Today. Opinion contributor Christopher Koopman has this next column from the February 8, 2024 edition of the USA Today. It's entitled, Can AI Steal the 2024 Election? Not if America uses this weapon to combat misinformation. Can democracy survive artificial intelligence? As the 2024 election approaches, there are mounting fears of an explosion in false and manipulative AI-generated content, especially by hostile foreign governments. The New York Times has warned of deepfakes that could swing elections. The Biden administration has already urged caution around the use of AI, and the possibility of electoral manipulation puts even greater pressure on the White House and Congress to slow or even stop AI's development. Yet the real solution is to speed up AI's rollout. The most powerful defense against electorally weaponized artificial intelligence is the defensive application of artificial intelligence. Any discussion of AI and elections must start with an uncomfortable fact. There's no way to stop the creation of AI-generated misinformation and disinformation. Powerful AI tools already exist, and so long as the United States has foreign enemies, they will use AI to try to influence the election. While the genie can't be put back in the bottle, its power can be nullified with even more powerful technology. The closest analogy is missile technology. Enemies make and use missiles, but we can intercept them with missiles of our own. The most obvious application of this approach is Israel's Iron Dome, which uses interceptor missiles to destroy incoming rockets. That's what America needs, an AI-powered information Iron Dome. Such a system would leverage AI's unprecedented pattern recognition ability to identify coordinated attacks using false AI-generated content, whether articles, images, or videos. AI is more than powerful enough to fulfill this role. Consider efforts over the past several years to train an AI model to detect lip-sync deepfakes. Humans struggle to say words beginning with M, B, or P without closing their mouths. Try saying peanut butter brittle. But deepfakes frequently ignore this reality. The casual observer might not realize it, but researchers have found that a trained model can identify those instances with surprising accuracy. Trained on videos of former President Barack Obama, their model spotted deepfakes over 90% of the time. AI is better than humans at finding deepfakes. Given the potential volume of such content, it would take an army of humans to identify AI-driven attempts to influence elections, requiring enormous sums of money and time while still suffering from human error. By contrast, AI tools could scan the internet far more quickly, efficiently, and effectively, labeling deepfakes almost as soon as they enter the public discourse. To use the rocket analogy, it's the difference between the high-tech integrated missile defense system and a swarm of soldiers with soldier-mounted rockets pointed toward the sky. There's a reason Israel chose the Iron Dome. Private companies should drive the creation of this cutting-edge technology. Putting election-focused AI in the hands of politicized agencies would invite abuse and undermine the very democracy we seek to protect. Nor is it wise to give government agencies vast regulatory power over AI and elections. The resulting burdens would likely stifle innovation, leaving the technology's development to a handful of larger companies. That would also undermine America's trust in democracy, given widespread concerns over bias within particular models. AI development should be encouraged at the widest and most diverse array of companies possible. Fierce competition will encourage companies to avoid ideology and provide the most effective products. Tech firms can develop the tools needed to safeguard elections. American companies are the world leaders in AI, so they're well-suited to develop this technology. The startup Deep Media is already helping the Pentagon detect deepfakes that threaten national security, like the deepfake of Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky telling his forces to surrender. Similar technology discovered that a famous artistic work by a previously unknown artist is actually a Raphael masterpiece, while another AI program determined that part of a different Raphael work was likely painted by someone else, based on microscopic clues across the artist's known paintings. If AI can decipher the secrets of Renaissance masters, it can ferret out deepfakes from Russia. Even rudimentary AI programs could quickly identify the still widespread use of comparatively low-tech election interference efforts, think troll farms in North Macedonia and the Philippines. As my colleague Neil Chilson, a former chief technologist at the Federal Trade Commission, explained in his recent testimony before the Senate, malicious actors don't use cutting-edge tech. Cheap fakes, selective editing, overseas content farms, and plain old Photoshop are inexpensive and effective enough. An AI Iron Dome would help identify these threats even faster, much as the actual Iron Dome protects against artillery shells as well as rockets. Uncertainty caused by the threat of regulation, along with ongoing and loud calls to pause AI development, has held back the maximum innovation in the election protection space. If policymakers make clear that companies can act within the bounds of existing law, the net benefits will almost certainly be felt before the November election. Foreign countries like Russia, China, and Iran are acutely aware of AI's power and are guaranteed to apply it to their election manipulation efforts if they aren't already. If America does anything other than fully unleash AI to protect our democracy, it will be a particularly foolish form of unilateral disarmament. Christopher Koopman is executive director for the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. And we've got time for one more column from the opinion section of the USA Today before we move on to articles from the money section. This one's entitled, Trump Thought the Courts Were Safe Bet Against Election Denial Charges. Now, not so much. And this is by Chris Brennan of the USA Today. Former President Donald Trump never hesitates to take contradictory positions if it helps his cause. He brags about appointing Supreme Court justices who overturned the right to abortion, but he won't say, while running again for president, what the federal or state governments should do now on that issue. He complains that America's southern border is in crisis, but he used his political sway over some Republicans in Congress this week to kill bipartisan legislation on immigration reform and border security. Does Trump believe in anything other than his own survival and success? The evidentiary record says no. But his proclivity to have things both ways just caught up with him in court. A 3-judge panel from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals called him out Tuesday for making one argument during his 2021 impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate and a completely antithetical argument now in his criminal case for trying to overthrow the 2020 presidential election after his loss to Joe Biden. And I suspect the U.S. Supreme Court will notice that contradiction, which could be trouble for Trump as soon as Monday. I'll come back to that. Does Trump prefer impeachment or the courts? At issue, Trump's lawyers successfully defended him in the 2021 impeachment proceedings by insisting the Senate was the wrong venue to consider punishing him for trying to overturn the 2020 election. They claimed then that criminal courts were built for that. A new team of Trump lawyers now argue in the courts that impeachment in the Senate was the correct venue all along to hold him accountable in the attempt to overturn the election, and that the former president is entitled to immunity now for what he did in office. The judges on page 34 of the 57-page ruling cite Trump's impeachment lawyers to clearly define how he's trying to have it both ways on accountability. Here was attorney David Schoen defending Trump in the Senate on the first day of his second impeachment on February 9, 2021. Quote, "We have a judicial process in this country. We have an investigative process in this country in which no former office holder is immune. That is the process that should be running its course," end quote. And here was Trump lawyer Bruce Castor arguing in the Senate impeachment trial 3 days later, quote, "There is only the text of the Constitution which makes very clear that a former president is subject to criminal sanction after his presidency for any illegal act he commits." There it is, word for word, proof from Trump's own lawyers that he's vulnerable to prosecution for what he did while president after the voters sent him home to sulk at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. One team of Trump lawyers was shooting down, ahead of time, the next team's tactics. Is that contradiction a solid legal strategy? One of those lawyers, Castor, told me this week he doesn't see a problem with two teams of Trump lawyers making conflicting arguments. It is well recognized in the law that lawyers may take alternative positions depending on the circumstances, Castor said. Wendy Weiser, Vice President for Democracy at the Brennan Center for Justice, agreed with the judges that the conflict is telling. She considers the arguments Trump's lawyers made in the criminal case not really serious. Their arguments were designed in the moment to evade accountability, she said. And Weiser was encouraged that the judges emphasized calling the former president Citizen Trump in what she called a slam dunk ruling. "He's not president," she said. "He is not a king. He is Citizen Trump and the subject of prosecution just like the rest of us. There is nothing special about him that would avoid that fundamental notion." Of course, Trump tries to burn it all down on social media. Trump responded Tuesday with a post on his website Truth Social deriding this week's appellate court ruling as nation-destroying while declaring that presidents must have full immunity in order to properly function and do what has to be done for the good of our country. He followed that less than a half hour later with a fundraising plea texted to supporters that said, "Moments ago, federal judges just ruled that I have no presidential immunity." Trump trying to cash in on the news was as predictable as him contradicting his own defense. The appellate court doesn't buy Trump's shtick. The judges clearly didn't buy Trump's claim of immunity, citing recent historical evidence that other presidents, including Trump, via his impeachment lawyers, have not believed themselves to be wholly immune from criminal liability for official acts during the presidency. They noted that President Richard Nixon was vulnerable for criminal indictment after he resigned in the Watergate scandal, something his vice president, Gerald Ford, made clear when he took over and pardoned his old boss. That 1974 pardon clearly said, "Nixon has become liable to possible indictment and trial for offenses against the United States, which could upset the tranquility his resignation created." And the judges cite President Bill Clinton agreeing in the closing hours of his second term to a 5-year suspension of his law license and a $25,000 fine in return for a special counsel agreeing not to prosecute him for providing false testimony under oath. What a rogues gallery. Nixon, Clinton, and Trump. Nixon resigned to avoid being tossed out of office. Clinton took the humiliating deal on his way out the door. But Trump is still trying to get back to the White House. His campaign said Tuesday that he will appeal the ruling. But where? Does Trump try his luck with appeal to Supreme Court, or does he stall? The 3-judge panel boxed him in, setting a Monday deadline to respond, with a clear eye on the long history of trying to stall legal cases. Trump could ask the full D.C. circuit of 11 judges to reconsider the case, but that would end a delay in the case moving ahead at the trial level. That goes against everything Trump really believes about civil and criminal courts. His core value has always been delay, delay, delay. He could also start the process of an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, chock full of justices he appointed, and the delay at the trial level will continue. But he has no guarantee there. The justices could refuse to even hear the case. That's what they did in February 2021 with a handful of remaining legal challenges to the 2020 election results, sending Trump and his allies away with no hearings. And this cuts across everything Trump really believes about loyalty. His core value here is he deserves loyalty in all things, at all costs. With the walls of this court case finally closing in on Trump and November's election looming, he needs a save from a Supreme Court that might not have an interest in helping. And his about-face defense tactics might have provided the justices with the perfect pretext to turn him away. And again, that column is from Chris Brennan of the USA Today. And that's it for the opinion section. We're going to move now to business articles from the money section of the February 8th, 2024 edition of the USA Today. And the first article is, what if the government abolished your 401k? Economists say accounts aren't worth it. And this is by Daniel DeVise of the USA Today. The federal government should stop subsidizing pre-tax contributions to retirement savings accounts, two economists from opposing ideological camps argued in a research brief in January. Allowing people to shelter their retirement money from taxes is a policy that largely favors the well-heeled, they said. Congress could use that money, nearly $200 billion a year in lost tax dollars, to shore up the underfunded Social Security program. Their suggestion created a stir. One social media post has drawn more than 700,000 views. We do not think that this subsidy, which you can only rationalize if it increases saving, we don't think it does increase saving very much, said Alicia Monell, a former assistant treasury secretary under President Clinton. She co-wrote the brief with Andrew Biggs, a senior fellow at the right-leaning American Enterprise Institute. Here's why economists are coming for your 401k. Why then are economists coming after your 401k? That employee retirement plan and its personal savings counterpart, the individual retirement account, were created to help Americans save for retirement. But federal data suggests tax-favored retirement accounts help only some Americans, and wealthy Americans in particular. For households in the top 10% by income, the median retirement account held $559,000 in 2022, according to the Survey of Consumer Finances. An overwhelming 93% of those households held retirement plans. For middle-income Americans, those in the 40th to 60th percentile by income, the median retirement plan held just $39,000, and nearly half of that group had no retirement savings. Many smaller employers don't offer 401k plans. Even when they do, workers might balk at participating because they can't spare the income or they're afraid they might need to withdraw it later on, triggering tax penalties. Income for a lot of workers is not very unpredictable, says Monique Morrissey, senior economist at the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute. Many researchers believe America faces a crisis in retirement savings. Fewer than half of us have retirement accounts, census data shows. Even among those nearing retirement, ages 56 to 64, the share with retirement accounts lagged below 60% in 2020. Without a retirement account, most retirees depend on Social Security, but monthly Social Security checks averaged about $1,800 in 2023. A typical household run by someone 65 or older spends $4,345 a month, according to a BlackRock analysis of federal statistics. The 401k and IRA emerged in the 1970s and gained popularity as tools for Americans to build savings for retirement. Over the years, the plans have gradually replaced traditional pensions, which deliver monthly benefits to retired workers. Between 1975 and 2019, active private sector pension participants dwindled from 27 million to fewer than 13 million, according to a congressional report. As investments, tax-advantaged retirement plans are a really good deal, said Damon Jones, a University of Chicago economist. The government doesn't tax income contributed to a traditional 401k or IRA. You pay tax when you withdraw the funds in retirement. The tax breaks cost the federal government about $185 billion a year in lost revenue, according to Treasury estimates for 2020. Yet, millions of Americans don't take advantage of tax-favored retirement savings, or can't. Nearly half of workers have no access to a retirement plan at work, according to one AARP analysis. And many lower-income Americans have more pressing priorities. Most people, middle class or lower, struggle to put food on the table and a roof over their head, and they don't have the money left over to save, said Steve Rosenthal, a senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Wealthier Americans, on the other hand, tend to take full advantage of the tax perks. According to research by the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, 3/5 of the retirement savings tax benefits go to people in the top 20% of Americans by income. More than 4/5 go to people in the top 40%. The fundamental problem with our retirement system is it rewards people who need no help, Rosenthal said. All the schemes are oriented toward rewarding those who have the savings or the income to reap the benefits. The whole point of the tax subsidies was to encourage more Americans to save for retirement, say the authors of the research brief, published by the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. But that hasn't happened. Between 1989 and 2022, the share of workers ages 25 to 64 who participate in employer-sponsored retirement plans has risen 2 percentage points from 51% to 53%, the researchers found. They're basically saying we ought to call it quits on our retirement tax system because it's broken, and it is broken, Rosenthal said. Agreement on that point is far from unanimous, and some in the retirement industry greeted the new research with vitriol. Brian Graff, chief executive of the American Retirement Association, flagged the paper on LinkedIn with the comment, "No, it's not April 1st, and I personally cannot think of a more preposterous idea." Much of the financial services industry applauds tax-favored retirement plans, saying they deliver a dignified retirement to millions of lower- and middle-income Americans. "It's not only the rich," said Craig Copeland, director of wealth benefits research at the Employee Benefits Research Institute, a nonprofit that works with benefit providers. "A lot of middle-class people have 401ks, and typically that's the bulk of their savings outside of their home." Strip away the tax benefits, Copeland says, and employers would lose their incentive to offer retirement savings in the first place. Companies use 401k plans to attract workers, and employers reap their own tax savings by administering the plans. "Most of these plans wouldn't exist if there wasn't a tax preference for them," he said. "Abolishing the tax subsidies is not going to hurt the wealthy," Copeland said, "because the wealthy are going to save. It's going to hit those middle quartile people, the middle class." Even the economists who wrote the brief concede there's little chance Congress will abolish tax-favored retirement savings anytime soon. "I know they're not going to repeal it tomorrow," Monell said, "but it should be part of the debate." Instead of eliminating the tax benefits, the economists say, Congress could modify the subsidies so the programs reward responsible saving without lavishing tax breaks on the wealthy. For example, the tax subsidy could be capped for savers who amass $500,000 or $1 million in retirement funds, or the tax benefit could be limited to the first $10,000 or $20,000 in annual contributions. Alternatively, Congress could lower the age by which savers must begin drawing down their retirement accounts. Instead of lowering that age, Congress has been raising it from 70 and a half in 2019 to 75 in 2033. "If you're troubled by how large these retirement plans are, you can limit what goes in," Rosenthal said, "or you can limit what comes out." And again, that's from Daniel DeVise of the USA Today. Jessica Quinn of the USA Today has this next article from the money section: "Cord Cutters and Cord Nevers. ESPN, Fox, and Warner Sports streaming platform want you." The new sports streaming venture from Fox, Disney's ESPN, and Warner Brothers Discovery is a major league play for sports fans who are cord cutters and cord nevers, meaning they no longer subscribe to a traditional pay TV bundle or never did. "There is no product serving the sports fans that are not within the cable TV bundle," Fox CEO Lachlan Murdoch said during his company's earnings call Wednesday. According to Disney CEO Bob Iger, the skinnier sports bundle that combines popular live sports from each of the media giants, such as ESPN's Monday Night Football, Fox's Sunday NFL games, and the March Madness college basketball tournament on Warner Brothers, will be a cheaper alternative to the big, fat, traditional cable package. He did not say how much the service will cost, only that it would be substantially less expensive to consumers than the big bundle they have to buy to get those same channels on cable and satellite. The typical cable bundle runs upward of $100 a month. The announcement of the new joint venture comes as consumers ditch traditional pay TV at an accelerated pace. The rapid decline in cable TV subscriptions is forcing media giants to follow their customers into the streaming world. There, they can compete for sports fans who have turned to popular internet alternatives such as YouTube TV and Fubo TV. "The opportunity is huge," Murdoch said, told analysts on Wednesday. Analysts estimate there are between 60 million and 70 million cord-cutter and cord-never households in the U.S., As cord cutting has accelerated, there has been increasing interest among many media company executives in creating new bundles of streaming services, in part because there is a belief that perhaps consumers don't want to manage as many separate subscriptions as they presently have, and because bigger bundles might lead to less subscriber churn, Brian Weiser, media analyst with Madison and Wall, said in a research note. A survey of 2,500 online adults in the U.S. in the third quarter of 2023 from S&P Global Market Intelligence's Kagan Media Research Group found that 51% were pay TV subscribers, 35% were cord cutters, and 14% were cord nevers. Recent cord cutters, in particular, are avid sports fans, said Seth Schaefer, senior research analyst in the Kagan Media Research Group. We believe there are a number of sports fans out there that want to watch sports on television but didn't want to sign up to the big cable and satellite bundle. We think they will be accretive to us, Iger said during his company's quarterly earnings call. We also believe that consumers who have left the bundle because it wasn't serving them well, or they may leave the bundle, we want to make sure we grab them too. The joint venture could accelerate the shift away from the traditional and more lucrative pay TV model. It seems highly likely that if an offering were appealing to consumers, it would almost certainly accelerate cord-cutting decision-making among many consumers who are only continuing with their traditional pay TV service in order to access the sports programming that will be included on the new service, Weiser said. Iger said Disney remains committed to pay TV. We intend to continue to be in it. We're investing in it in terms of the channels that we own, running them more efficiently, but we also have to be mindful of where the consumer is now and where the consumers go, Iger told CNBC's Julia Burstyn. Murdoch made similar comments, saying the target customer is a sports fan who does not subscribe to pay TV and denying the joint venture would affect pay TV partners. We remain, I think, the biggest supporters of the traditional pay TV bundle, he said. Cable TV operators weren't briefed on the plans for the joint venture. Fox, Disney, and Warner Brothers expect revenue on par with what they receive from cable and satellite TV distributors. The linear business is still a business that serves us well and that it's profitable for us, and we intend to continue to be in it. We're investing it in terms of the channels that we own, running them more efficiently, but we're still in that business. But we also have to be mindful of where the consumer is now and where the consumers go, Iger told Burstyn, and it looks like a repeat paragraph. Subscribers of streaming services like Disney Plus, Hulu, and Max will be able to subscribe to the new sports streaming service as part of the bundle. Disney also plans to offer a standalone ESPN streaming app as soon as August, Iger said. Bailey Schultz of the USA Today has this next article from the money section. Zillow launches individual room listings as Americans struggle with higher rent and housing costs. With home prices and rent dramatically up since the start of the pandemic, a growing number of Americans are looking for ways to cut their monthly housing expenses. One common solution? Roommates. The rental marketplace Zillow, on Thursday, announced the option to search for individual room listings. A beta testing mode for the feature first launched in certain markets in November, ahead of this week's full launch, and there are already an estimated 10,000 single room listings nationwide. The room feature is a way for us to expand the affordable selection to our renters, in addition to providing more optionality for landlords and homeowners, potentially, to help offset mortgage costs, said Lily Ferguson, the senior product manager at Zillow, who was behind the Room for Rent launch. The stress of finding roommates. David Smith, a 33-year-old based in New York City, lived in a four-bedroom Brooklyn Heights apartment with a rotating cast of roommates between 2012 and 2018. Since it was Smith's name on the lease, he said each time a roommate moved out, he was tasked with finding a replacement. If he failed to move fast enough, he risked paying double his $1,000 monthly share of the rent. It's a stressful process, especially when there is months remaining on the lease. That's something that I couldn't afford covering on my own, he said. So you're in the need of somebody, but you don't want it to be just anybody. In 2019, about one-third, 32.2% of U.S. adults lived in a shared household with at least one adult resident who was not the householder's partner or spouse, according to census data. This figure includes adult children living with parents and adult roommates, but does not count those aged 18 to 24 enrolled in school. Since then, housing has only become more expensive. A report from Zillow says the income required to comfortably spend the recommended 30% of income on rent for the median renter is up 40.6% since pre-pandemic times to $79,264. And despite positive economic indicators like waning inflation and a resilient labor market, Americans say they are struggling in the current economy. That's pushing more renters to find roommates. Affordability continues to be a challenge, Ferguson said. Adding in roommates can also help make mortgage payments more affordable for homeowners who face a 30-year fixed mortgage rate of more than 7%. How to search for individual rooms on Zillow? Zillow's app now features a room filter under the Home Type drop-down menu. Renters can search for a room in a single-family rental, condominium, or townhome based on a budget, lifestyle, and preferred location. The feature is available nationwide, but it is especially popular in larger cities like Los Angeles, Boston, and Atlanta. You're going to see a larger cluster of rooms in those major metropolitan areas where affordability continues to be a challenge, Ferguson said. Her advice? Stick to fan favorites in terms of food and snacks, and don't be afraid to let someone else do the cooking. Here's some more Super Bowl party tips from Donna Kelsey. You don't have to cook everything. While there may be a few family favorites you want to prepare, perhaps that buffalo chicken dip, there's nothing wrong with ordering out, Kelsey told USA Today. For instance, if you don't have time to clean and cut veggies or fruit, supermarkets do trays and fruit bowls. Don't make it complicated. Admittedly, Kelsey has been watching Super Bowls in person over the last few years, but when the family would have a watch party, the choice was always chicken wings and pizza, things that were easy and that could be delivered, Kelsey said. Don't let food go to waste. If you cook anything, make sure it's leftover friendly. For instance, Kelsey said her family likes to reuse chili to make chili dogs the next day, and any leftover dips become a part of loaded nachos, she said in a statement. Leftover veggies can be used in chicken noodle soup. Just add some chicken broth, toss in any meat from leftover chicken wings, and add some egg noodles. A Ziploc survey suggests at least 18 million pounds of leftovers were thrown out after watch parties last year, but hosts can make sure that that's not the case at their party, said Kelsey, who has been named Ziploc's chief leftover officer for the Super Bowl. That's all we have time for. Thanks for listening. This has been the opinion section and the money section of the February 8th, 2024 edition of the USA Today. Enjoy the Super Bowl this Sunday. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Doug Jenkins.